accession number 17896, Reel 7.
This is General Purton, Reel 4. Right, if you'd like to just backtrack on what you said.
Yes, sure.
Company.
Yes, well, the 3rd Division, you see, of Sarawak, it was really served by this enormous river, the Rejang, which was navigable for 100 miles. To a steamer could go up 100 miles to a place called Capit. And I had a company of green jackets under command, and so that I had 4 company bases out in the jungle. And they were obviously surrounded with barbed wire and with slit trenches. And platoons operated from there and patrolled the likely approach routes.
On foot,
yes. And if there was somewhere where you wanted to put people down, which was really rather a long way away, you then flew them in by helicopter and would hope that the intelligence you had, you weren't going to land them where there were any Indonesians. But there wasn't a great deal of activity in the 3rd Division. And so we were then moved down to the 1st Division because they had a Malay battalion there, and they'd done awfully badly. I mean, my brigadier thought they never went into the jungle. He said they've always got creases in their trousers and their boots are clean and everything else. And the Indonesians were coming into all the local kampongs and, you know, tramping all around the place. And he said to me, I want you to go down there and relieve the battalion. They'll come up to your area. So we went down there, and we found it was a different modus operandi down there because we then went to platoon positions. And really, from the 2nd Division, we had a great friend called Nicky Neal commanding the 2nd Gurkhas. Then there was myself commanding the Ulster Rifles. And then a chap called David House, who was commanding the Green Jackets, 1st Royal Green Jackets. And they were based on Kuching. But we were literally along the Indonesian border there. And we were perpetually having people coming over. And we were having fights with them. We were in platoon positions then. And the idea was you'd make your platoon position so they could be held by a section. And the other 2 sections went out on patrol, aggressive patrolling. But what you would do is you would put... you would dig your slit trenches for everyone so that everyone would be in a slit trench. You gave it overhead cover so that if they mortared you or threw grenades, you'd got thick cover overhead, which you used with timbers and earth. And then you had, outside that, you'd have, beyond grenade throwing distance, you had your barbed wire fence round the whole place. You know, real difficult to get through. And then beyond that, you had low wire entanglement, so that you had to get through the low wire entanglement before you could get to the actual wire. And then we had pits with punjis in them, which were sharpened bamboo stakes with poison in the end of them. And I think, in fact, we didn't dip them in poison. I think they were automatically poisonous. And, of course, if you've got one of those through your boot, unless you've got unless it was the sole of your boot and you've got metal there, I mean, you know, you've got a very nasty wound which went bad. And then we had trip flares of 2 sorts. One was trip flares that were set off by the enemy themselves, and others that were operated from your base, so the platoon commander would have some, so that if he thought he heard a noise and his trip flare hadn't gone up, he could then press a switch or pull a switch and the flares would go up, or he could fire dairy cartridges, or he could fire a star shell.
Did you use mines at all on the trails?
In ambushes I used the Claymore.
Is that the
that's the one. It looks a bit like it's about 4 inches high. It's curved towards the enemy. It's about, I suppose, 2 inches thick, and it is loaded with ball bearings and high explosive. and it is lethal. And I never put any mines around any of my platoon positions, but if I had an ambush out, you would cover part of your area with claymores, so that if the enemy was surprised and they're running away, say, down a track, then all you would do was fire your claymore, and you hoped that you caught them as they came by it.
Oh, you
know.
Fire them remotely?
Yes, you could. Fire them. No, you fire them remotely.
Ah, yeah.
Or you could fire them by a trip.
Yeah.
They were excellent.
And then you pick them up afterwards, presumably.
Oh, God, yes. If they hadn't gone off.
Yeah.
Or if you hadn't used them. Of course you did, yes. Now, that's the thing, you see.
What were those delightful weapons the Americans used in Vietnam, where the thing would jump up in the air?
Oh, yes. Well, the Germans had that. There was we used to call it a shoe mine. It'd jump up in the air and then explode.
Yeah.
Bloody awful.
Yeah.
No, we'd never had anything like that.
Mm.
And we did not put mines down there. No, certainly in my battalion, definitely not. And as you know, it's the British Army principle that a minefield, every single mine's location is marked on the minefield chart so that you can pick them all up, you know they are. Germans did the same, you could always tell where the mines were and you could pick them up. But unfortunately nowadays, the sort of people who've been waging warfare recently just throw mines all over the bloody place and in the most awful way, and this is why we have all these maimed people walking around in places like Mozambique and believe they have, yeah.
The troops under your command there, were they all Brits or did you have local Malaysians as well?
I had, in the 3rd Division, I had my own battalion and I had a company of border scouts, but they did not work as a company. You just had these people living in longhouses all around the border and they would go out every day, and they were EBANs, yes. In my area, they were EBANs. They could have been Muruts or Kayans, all depending what part of Borneo they were in. And
useful as guides, presumably.
I never used them as guides, but they would have been useful as guides. Mm. I had a company of Sarawak Police Field Force, who were all local people, and they were jolly good. I think eventually they raised the Malaysian Rangers in Borneo as well. In fact, now I've mentioned it, I'm not sure that I'm not talking balls. I'm not sure that my Sarawak Police Field Force may not have been Malays. I honestly can't remember. They got a very good Brit commanding them called Bill Crennell, who was a superintendent. In the 3rd Division, I had 7 Royal Naval vessels. Small ones, had landing craft and 6 launches, because, you know, what with the Rajang River and all sorts of other rivers, and the coast, and I needed them. And in support, I had 845 helicopter squadron. When we moved to the 1st Division, I had 1 helicopter of the Army Air Corps permanently at my disposal, and otherwise we were in the hands of the Royal Air Force, and we had to ask them. And they'd only got whirlwinds. The Navy had Wessex, which were really good. And I had a little Hiller they always gave me with a Royal Naval Lieutenant piloting it. We had rather different treatment from the Royal Air Force, who went very much by the book. And they didn't live with us, whereas the Navy did. And it was very difficult to compare to being with the Navy, get this close relationship. Eventually managed to get it. I got a new squadron leader came in of the squadron that generally supported our area. He was a good chap and he and I got on well. And, we got more together with them then, but at first it was terribly difficult. They wouldn't let you sit up in front with the pilot, whereas that's for your automatic place. I mean, you can't do a reconnaissance facing sideways or backwards, but the RAF didn't seem to appreciate that. So we had a lot of trouble to start with. But it was teething troubles. We got over it.
Now, eventually, the effectiveness of your relentless campaign put the Indonesians off from invading. And,
yes.
The numbers of incursions reduced, I suppose, did they?
Yes, they did. Well, we had a thing, General Walter Walker had a thing, which was at that time secret, called Claret. And we were allowed to operate over the border into Indonesia. And by doing this, we discourage them from, you know, forming up near the border, and they'd keep back. The Gurkhas gave them some really bloody noses. I mean, you know, the Gurkhas had, well, I mean, there was a VC gained in one of the battles they had. And really, it was just this relentless campaign of virtually taking the war to them. The SAS we used as well, they were very good out there, especially on information and hearts and minds. I had a Gurkha parachute company with my battalion for a bit, and then I had the Guards Independent Parachute Company for a little bit. And then after that we had the SAS, and they were all very good. The SAS were especially good.
Did you have many problems with sickness in the jungle? Diseases?
No. Bite? We could have had. Mm. I was warned by a number of people when I did my first reconnaissance of Borneo. General Walker gave me a chit to visit three different battalions, one in Sabah, one in Brunei, and one in Sarawak. And the COs all said to me, don't let your men swim in the river because they'll get encephalitis. And the rats' urine, the rats who were all in the reeds and everything, their urine was the source of encephalitis, because I think a mosquito would get that somehow or other, and then it would inject it, you know, and you could turn into a cabbage with that. So I gave an order, which was a thoroughly unpopular order in my battalion, that, leptospirosis, not encephalitis, leptospirosis. And I gave an order that no one was allowed to bathe in the river. If we had to cross it operationally, as we often did, we would do so, but there would be no sort of splashing around. And it was I used to feel an absolute shit, quite frankly, because, you know, at the end of a hot day, I used to go out with my boys, naturally, of course, had to, but you'd come to a riverbank and there'd be gravel and the water looked absolutely clear. And it was so inviting, you know, and if it was, you've got sentries out and so on, you could well have bathed. But I just stuck to this thing that no one will swim, and we never got a single case of leptospirosis. But apart from that, none of my guys got malaria, because we always took Paludrin every day.
You had the usual jabs for other nasties, I suppose.
Yeah, we had a lot of injections, I think, before we went out there. If you got
leeches at all?
Yes, lots of leeches, yes. Yeah. But again, whether you smoked or not, you know, you got a cigarette and burnt them off. And any sore you got, unless you treated it immediately, went septic. But apart from that, we were a very healthy battalion.
Where was your nearest medical backup, nearest hospital?
Kuching.
Uh-huh. And then you had helicopters to
yes.
take them up.
Yes.
Did you suffer many casualties there?
No, I didn't. I only had one man killed, and he was killed recovering a boat that had got loose, and he got caught in an undertow and drowned before we could get at him. That was in the 3rd Division. And I had one man killed, I'm sorry to say, by an accidental discharge. And those are the only two casualties I had. We had some chaps wounded and so on, but nothing worth talking about. Now, thank God, I brought my... Well, I didn't bring my battalion back because I had to hand them over 2 months before I handed over command... 2 months before they left Borneo. But they came back minus two men, which wasn't too bad, I think. Another thing I insisted on... again, there's nothing clever about these things. They're things we all knew in the British Army, but sometimes people forget them. Before my guys went out on a patrol, or before they went out to operate in the jungle, I wouldn't allow them in the jungle at all to wear an aftershave or to use scented soap, because the Indonesian, as I discovered when I was in Malaya, you can be smelt a long way away. And therefore, the best thing you can do, because you dry so quickly, you see, it's so hot, is to really get into a pool of water or something, you know, and you don't smell. But in any case, you don't smell if you don't put on Trumpo's hair oil and that sort of thing, you know, which I had one young man who thought he was going to wear that. That's one thing. Another thing, obviously, is that nothing must rattle or make a noise when you go out, because obviously you must not give yourself away. No smoking. I would never allow that. They could smoke in their base camp, no smoking, because you know how cigarette smoke smells. And I had aiming posts put out in every platoon position and every company position where I had got sentry posts. So at night, when the rest of the chaps were sleeping, you had your sentry posts. And I had an aiming mark out at about, all depending on how close the jungle was, but I'd make bloody sure that there was an aiming post out there and that we knew how far it was. And we would have a bang at it just to know that, you know, that you could hit it. And before anyone went into the jungle at all, they all had to test their weapons. Obviously, if you're on a patrol, you don't test your weapons. You're going to give yourself away. But before you leave your base, everyone tests the weapons. And when you come back into your base again, every weapon has got to be cleared so there isn't a round up the spout and then someone presses the trigger and some poor chap's dead or wounded. But I've...
Just in parenthesis...
yes.
Of course, the standard weapon by this time was what? I mean, the Oakley Enfield had long since been pensioned off.
I let my guys carry whatever they wanted to on what we had. I looked upon our armoury as a golf bag. We had Armalite rifles, which were very light.
These are Americans?
Yes. And they could fire semi-automatic as well, which is good if you suddenly bumped on someone. We had the little short jungle rifle, which was .303, but it had a short butt. It was a jolly good little rifle. I used to carry an Armalite, actually, but I had carried the previous little one in, or shorter one in
this
Malaya.
Was a bolt action.
Yes, it was bolt action. I also allowed my guys to have what they call pump guns. You know, there's a shotgun, and you could get off quite a lot of number of rounds. Also, M79s, which you had a thing like a sort of blunderbuss, which fired this shell, which exploded, and rather like almost like a grenade. And so some of my guys had M79s, and I used to let the company commander decide what he wanted to carry, as long as they all carried weapons. You get one company that swore by the GPMG, and so they carried GPMGs. Another company think the GPMG was too heavy. They carried Brens, and luckily I had enough weapons to be able to allow them to use what weapons suited them best. I didn't have enough weapons, of course, that everyone could have the weapon he wanted best. But in general, if a company commander wanted to equip his patrol or his platoon in a certain way, I gave them the latitude to do it.
What about, did you have any foot trouble?
Just let me think.
I mean, you had lightweight footwear, presumably, for the jungle.
We had jungle boots, which are, you wore a green boot which came up to your knee, just under your knee.
I mean, I was astonished to read in the Falklands campaign that people were suffering from trench foot then.
Yes, I know. No, because we had a rule that people washed their feet every day and powdered them. And you had to put on clean socks. But also, I used to, once my guys were back in, certainly in company base, I let them wear just a pair of shorts, the ones who weren't on sentry and so on, I let them wear a pair of shorts and flip-flops, so that the air got to their toes, the air got to their feet, the air got to their body. And therefore, if you were out in the jungle on a long patrol, you could well get prickly heat. And you also got all sorts of other things. I mean, you get leech bite, you'd get you get these bloody awful thorns that would, you know, cut right into your body. You could be bitten by these bulldog ants. I was, and I know what they're like. Excruciating pain they have. You know, I was bitten the backside when I was crossing a rotten log. And one of these fellows gave me a nip, and my God, I was almost sick with the pain of it. But in general, I would have said that we had very, very little of any sort of medical problems there. And you always knew that if you got a chap wounded, you could get him out bloody quickly in a helicopter. And the helicopters flew, certainly the naval ones, flew in any weather, and day or night. I know, because I flew in them. I've flown in the most bloody awful storms in Tank Sherman's 845 squadron. I think it was Digby Lickfold who flew me one night. We thought we had a platoon that was in trouble at a place called Nunga Ghat, which is where that Temenggong Juga lived, who was the paramount chief of the Ebans. And there was a naval base there. And we thought that the platoon there, platoon commander, was very inexperienced, and he thought he was being attacked. And I flew in with a company, oh no, a platoon of the standby company at night in a rainstorm. And so that I had utter confidence wherever I wanted to go, if I had to get a casualty out, the Navy would get them out for me. And I'm sure the RAF would have as well. Patterson, I mean, they were superb leaders. And
you were there how long, between which years?
We were there for 64, 1964. We did a year in Borneo. Mm-hmm. I think we did the first unaccompanied year of any unit in the British Army. I think we did.
And the morale was good.
Terrific. Mm. Yeah, I was awfully lucky. General Walker called us his white Gurkhas. I mean, I was so bloody lucky. I mean, Irish soldiers are great. And, well, so are all our British soldiers. But, you know, if Irish soldiers are proud of themselves, you know, we had morale that was just second to none. Wonderful. Most uplifting to be with them. You know.
Anyhow, you completed your job out there.
Yes.
And you came back for a bit to the School of Infantry.
Yes, I was made chief instructor, and also what they called officer commanding the all-arms battle group course, which was, the idea was that officers of the rank of major and captain from all arms and corps of the service came for a six-week course at the School of Infantry to learn how to command a combat team of all arms. In other words, a battalion, a squadron of tanks, a troop of sappers. Really, that was the sort of basic. And I had Royal Signallers as well. I had chaps from the Ordnance Corps and Service Corps and so on. And we did it rather like the Staff College. We had a lecture, first of all, on whatever subject we were studying, followed by a cloth model demonstration on the floor of the Blenheim Hall, which is a big room at Warminster. And my DS were very high-powered chaps. They came from all arms of the services. And they used to, again, they used to act, and they were bloody funny as well. And they were terribly topical. I mean, for example, I remember one of my demonstrations started off, you walked into the hall, and there was Petula Clark singing My Kind of Place, whatever it was called, I don't know. I mean, which completely threw all these very serious sort of students. No, we should have been. No. The record. Yes. And they took the mickey out of everyone. And I've always been keen on physical fitness, and people have always laughed at me doing press-ups and so on. And my first week there, suddenly on the screen was flashed up a picture of a most curvaceous blonde lying on a beach on her back in a bikini. And there's a chap doing his press-ups over her, and underneath it says, would you kindly go and do your push-ups somewhere else? But what they'd done was they'd superimposed my face onto this chap, you see. so that everyone had the Mickey taken out of them. But it was a very happy atmosphere, and the chap I took over from, General Sir Jack Harmon, as he became, he had done away with reports, and which I thought was a terribly good idea, and I followed that. So no one had a report written on him. So he would never felt under pressure. I mean, had he been idle, I'd have made quite sure he knew he'd been idle. But they came there to learn. And what happened was that you might come as a captain in the Royal Tanks and find yourself on an exercise commanding an infantry company of our demonstration battalion. Or you might find yourself as its commanding officer. Or as an infantryman, sapper or signaller, you find yourself commanding a squadron of tanks. We had our own squadron. We had our own battalion. We had our own affiliated Royal Engineer troop. We had our affiliated battery at Lark Hill. And all these were brought over, and we exercised on the plane. And these chaps just took over command. And so, and the thing was, I used to say, well, look, you know, do your best. If you make a balls up of it, nothing's going to matter. No one's going to write it on your report. And the only people who know you've made a cock of it is the chaps who are with you. But for God's sake, do it now rather than do it later on for real. And it really was a terribly good course. Very happy course. And that, I think I was there from the end of 64 until 66. The end of 66. I think I must have done 2 years there.
Although this was called the School of Infantry, it was very much a meeting point for all the various
for that
of the army.
For that particular course.
I mean, you had armoured people coming there.
Yes. So, for this course only.
Yeah.
All the others were infantry platoon commander courses, infantry signals courses and all that sort of thing. I had my own signals wing, commanded by a Royal Signals Lieutenant Colonel. And it was geared to the infantry, but this one course was all arms, and I think it did a hell of a lot of good. Mm. Really did. They used to say to me they got tremendous confidence out of it.
Was there a corresponding school of armour somewhere where infantrymen could go?
No. They didn't do it there.
Was the only meeting point of it?
No, we had an infantry major at the armoured school at Bovington. But they didn't do it. You see, really, it would have been uneconomic for more than one place to do it. Mm. And we had the facilities at Warminster. We had the demonstration battalion. We had the demonstration squadron. Yeah.
So, you were there, what, for a year?
A couple of years.
So, really, your career is checkered in the sense that you've got years of activity.
Yes.
And then years of consolidation.
Yes.
And spreading your experience further around.
Yes.
And then back to more activity.
And gaining an awful lot of experience because, quite honestly, I learned so much because I had to give lectures and so on. And sometimes I had to give lectures, you know, on things that really I knew very little about. And I found myself, I had to cancel a nuclear counterattack exercise. It had been written by someone before me, and I said to my DS, I said, I can't understand this. I'm not going to stand up in front of all these high-grade young officers here and tell them something I don't believe in. It's absolute balls. So what I did was I cancelled it completely, and I had a day when we studied Borneo, where I really knew what I was talking about. And my fellows all confessed to me afterwards, thank God you got rid of that. None of us understood it, but my predecessor did. And he was brilliant, and he understood it, but I didn't. So I got rid of that. But I found that I had to work every night preparing myself for the next day. And, you see, and when you know you're on your feet, and you've got very bright young men asking you questions, you learn a hell of a lot. And I think it broadened my professionalism enormously to have done those 2 years as chief instructor there.